This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848. Or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Kim Litton, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. This episode features a conversation with my friend Kim Litton, who is a licensed psychotherapist in North Palm Beach, Florida. And this conversation took place right as all the COVID-19 social distancing stuff started to take hold and we all started to retreat into our homes and stop meeting with each other face to face. And we had a great conversation. Kim has worked in the field of addiction treatment and has had training and specializes in treating sex addiction. And I just really appreciate her coming on and enjoy the conversation. So here you go, Kim Litton. You know, like every therapist, you have an area of expertise where you focus. And so tell everybody what your wheelhouse is.
I do. My wheelhouse has, you know, pretty organically defaulted to addiction and people who are affected by addiction, whether it be partners or, you know, parents, partners and such. Addiction is a kind of a broad term. So my most recent specialty that I've been credentialed in is sex addiction, which is my, you know, my most recent passion. So that's, a cool thing for me, because not only am I able to help addicts, it's really the partners of addicts that I find, appreciate this specialty, almost not more than the addict, but, just as much as the addict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that particular, I guess illness for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. There's a lot of suffering on the part of the partners. So it's very traumatic.
So much suffering.
Episode a while back with a guy who's a pornography addiction expert.
Oh, awesome.
And he talked a lot about that because, you know, all of this, more pornography addiction, less sex addiction, but it's all pretty new. I mean, all of addiction is a relatively new discipline.
1,000%. Absolutely.
Of treating it. But, you know, he's a writer and he found his way into doing this work because when he, I don't know, what do you call it when someone heals from a sex addiction or pornography? He didn't become abstinent. I mean, he became abstinent from pornography addiction, but when he entered into recovery, he found very few resources for himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he lived in a relatively rural area. There, you know, it was like 2 hours to a meeting once a week. So what he started to do was to put himself out there online, and people started reaching out to him. And he ended up writing a book.
Yeah, I'm so glad you kind of brought that up, because that's exactly what led me into that specialty as well. And then when you're in that pain, and it is the most painful spot I've probably ever been in my life, and I've experienced some pretty bad emotional pain. And when you're in that pain, not being able to find the help. And I know Patrick Carnes, he talks about that as well, as when he went through his own, you know, bottom in the 70s, of how, you know, there was no help for him, you know, and there was no, I mean, there was help. There's people who are definitely wanting to help and 1000% open to learning and wanting to be in your process with you. It's not like that, but they just didn't get it.
Right.
And to just feel so incredibly alone and think, okay, I've got to change this for women. I mean, what I would give to have had a me when I was going through my pain. Right. I would have given any, there is no dollar amount on that. There really isn't. You know, somebody who has been through it, not only been through it, but has gotten trained, formally trained and specializing in such a area of addiction that no one really wants to look at still. You know, the public just does not want to admit that it's a thing still, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, the other part about it that, you see it, trying to think about where I've seen this pop up its head, but you know, it's one of those things where it's kind of laughed about, the idea of sex addiction. Like, well, if I was going to have an addiction, I would want it to be a sex addiction. You know, you hear say, which is just ignorant, because if you realize how much pain it causes, so, I mean, it really exists.
For sure. Well, and that's what is so good. That's what my partners tell me. And when I say my partners, I'm referring to partners of sex addicts that I see. That's why they find it so refreshing to come to me, because they view it. They have no clue what sex addiction is. They're like, what on earth? You know, they have been completely traumatized by their partner, you know, either being arrested, being on the news, even, you know, I mean, something horrible has had to happen for them, finding out they're having an affair. Something terrible has had to happen for their loved one to say, I've got a major, you know, something embarrassing and horrible happened and really traumatic. So they come into me like almost in that belief of like, how could he, you know, almost like looking at it like, you know, how could he or she, but not only that, like the mentality of like, they're out there having fun, or they're out there having, you know, sex, which equals fun to a lot of people, you know, they're out there doing this or doing that. And to, for me to kind of guide them in the situation is like, no, they are incredibly sick. Like they are so sick that this is actually not fun to them anymore, oddly enough, you know, and to get them to see the human in that, and to get them to see the illness, and to get them to see the really vulnerable piece of their partner is really helpful to them, because they are so angry. They are so angry and so hurt and betrayed that they really need to be heard and validated, of course, for that anger. But they also need to be able to heal through that, need to be able to somehow, some way view their partner as a human being and not a monster. You know what I mean? And so it's a really, a gradual and graceful walk of like helping somebody to see that. And, I really, have a lot of clients who express their gratitude for that, because they would have never really, you know, maybe gotten there had it not been for, you know, someone who's not only experienced that. I have experienced betrayal trauma as well with my first husband, my ex-husband, I mean, is what I'm trying to say. So that betrayal trauma, you know, not only have I experienced it, but I have gotten to the other side of where, you know, I see it totally as a human experience and, you know, a real, real true painful sickness. So it's neat. I mean, of course I geek out on it and I could talk about it for days, but.
So now, am I mistaken? You were a therapist before you studied that though. Isn't that right? I mean,
I was a therapist before I studied that. Yes. So I got into, you know, I went to school 18 years old, graduated high school and got into social work. You know, went to college, got into social work major right away because I knew that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to help people. I knew I wanted to be a therapist. Oddly enough, you know, looking back on it, I think I was wanting to fix myself as well. And my addiction grew worse and worse. You know, but all the while still having that empathic piece of me that loved human development and learning about that, and how we learn, what we, and our patterns show up in all kinds of things, our patterns from childhood. So, you know, all the while I'm still really interested in that, but still fighting my own addiction and the control of it all, on my own. So at, 26, I had been to 7 different colleges and still hadn't received a bachelor's degree. Was very close, but still hadn't been there. You know, I came to the bottom of my own addiction and got help. I came down here to South Florida. Obviously by my accent, I'm not from Florida. So I came down here from East Tennessee to Florida for my addiction, and I stayed and I finished those degrees and credentials and all of that while, you know, getting married to my recovery husband and having the kids and all of that, you know. So, yeah, exactly. And then what year was it? I think I was like 7 years clean and sober. I got my divorce. 9 years I was in a very painful place, in my recovery, and started experiencing my own sex and love acting out and insanity. And then I think year 13, it was like 2015 for me, it's when I went to get the credential of the CSAT, which is the Certified Sex Addiction Therapist. So, and that's when, 2015 was when I began my own sobriety for that, my recovery for that. So 2016, I'm sorry, is when I got my credential for the CSAT. So, exactly. I was a therapist and acting out in my own other addiction, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well,
very painful place.
Well, and you know, you mentioned you're like me, you've been working in this industry for a long time and you came to South Florida from somewhere else.
Yep.
To get clean and sober. And you know, you and I both did that long enough ago that our recovery and our early experience in recovery preceded the time when South Florida had kind of earned this reputation as a bad place for, for people to go. And, you know, I bring this up because I know people in the world of addiction treatment are going to be listening to this. And I know, like, I resent hearing people denigrate South Florida as a place to get sober because, you know, you and I both watched this all happen.
Oh,
I mean, I saw it coming. And I thank God that I had the mentors that I had. And, you know, when I got down here in the mid 90s, there were maybe a half dozen treatment facilities that were all fantastic. And, you know, there were slime balls here, just like there are everybody everywhere else, but there weren't, they weren't like visible. Like, and, and then, you know, 10, 15 years later, it's like they've all taken over. And it went from, you know, I was running a transitional living facility in the mid 2000s, and I would get referrals from the best treatment facilities in the world where therapists would tell parents, you know, I don't care where your son goes, he just needs to go to South Florida. Which at the time I knew was really irresponsible because everywhere you go, there are good places and bad places. And and, but that quickly went to, over the course of a few years, anywhere but, you know, don't go anywhere but South Florida. And now what I'm seeing as a referring professional is that unscrupulous, professionals, quote unquote, or, facilities around the country are trying to use that to their advantage, saying, oh, don't send them to Florida. Where the truth is, like, things have gotten cleaned up here in a major way. There are a lot of great treatment facilities down here that didn't exist before that. So,
No, exactly. Yeah, I didn't realize that's still happening, Tom, but so there, people are using that as an excuse, like to try to get you to send your kid somewhere else.
I don't know. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to let people know, like, this was a good place to come. Like, thank God I came here. I mean, it, it changed the course of my life for the better. And there's like, I mean, a lot of family members, a lot of people whose lives have changed. As a result of me coming here.
My parents still come down every year for my anniversary. I mean, just like we did our very first year, you know, we made it a big deal. Like you would make your birthday, you know, and, they come down. My dad has given me my medallion. My mom's still nervous too. My sister's given me my medallion. You know, like it's a big, big deal for my family. And they will still say that, you know, they don't know where I would be today if I hadn't come here, you know. And it is. I mean, I am so, so sorry to the families who have lost loved ones, who have trusted, you know, the industry in South Florida. You know, that pains me to think that, you know, that could have been mine or your mom and dad too. But, you know, we have cleaned it up so much here. And, you know, there are people like you and I down here treating kids and, you know, loved ones of addiction and with addiction. And we would never, I mean, we totally vet all those nasty places out. And really, if you're down here in the mix of things, they kind of show themselves, and it's really not hard to spot out. It's just, you know, it's about doing a lot of research too. And so, absolutely. I mean, we're so lucky because, you know, we're a mecca of, not only do we have a plethora of AA meetings and recovery groups, but it's other meetings too, like COSA and CODA and, you know, ACA. ACA and, you know, and all of these, you know, things that stem from the 12 steps of AA, you know, that we are readily available, you know.
Well, and the ancillary services, like a therapist who knows sex addiction. You know,
no,
I mean,
you don't, absolutely.
Like, yeah, the all the ancillary services, like psychiatrists who really understand addiction, and and, you know, people who specialize in trauma. You know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. I have always tried to position myself as a protector of families. And when I get a call from someone out of state, be sure to say, listen, whether or not I can help you at my place, you can call me and I'll help you. And if you have any questions about wherever it is you think you should send your son or daughter or spouse, ask me. I'll be honest with you. I'll tell you,
right.
You know, and that has gone a long way. And I've gotten feedback from family members. Just thank God we found you because we could tell you were honest. So it's you're right. It's not really hard to tell, you know, if you're paying correct attention and I've tried to also position myself with professionals in the industry around the country. If you have any questions about places down here, call me. If I don't know anything about it, I know someone who does, or if I need to go check it out myself for you, I will. You know, because what matters to me is that people get the help that they need.
For sure.
And
absolutely.
And it really, what it boils down to is the people who are doing the work, who are, you know, and where their heart is. And which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because I know that you have a pure heart and you really do have a heart for this. And
thank you, Tom.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I am. You know, I truly believe that God made me for this. That's just a true, true belief of mine. And I believe that, you know, God has taken me through absolutely every single thing that I've needed to go through to be able to help people through their own pain. So there's just no doubt in my mind I'm supposed to be doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I mean, just like you said, it is my responsibility to be able, and I truly look at it as my true responsibility to be able to offer to my clients exactly what I would offer to my family members, exactly what I would want offered to me. And so, you know, I take that very seriously of like, even like you said, with psychiatrists, I want to get to know all kinds of people in this community and get to know them like on a personal level so that I can sniff them out to refer. Cause you know, there's so many people that come to me that need medication. So they need a psychiatrist, you know, so I need to know people like that. I need to know, you know, there are people who come to me who would have a gambling addiction. I don't treat gambling addiction. I don't know the actual ways to treat gambling addiction. I need to know somebody to refer them to. I can't act like I'm an everything therapist, you know, or else I'm not going to do them the best, you know, what they need and what could fit or help them the very best way possible, if that makes sense. So just little things like that, is so important for ethics and just our commitment to this profession, period, you know, is, you know, we're here to help people, not to hurt people and not to heal ourselves through other people either. You know, this is, or through our patients, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, I take this so seriously and I love what I do, but I don't take myself too seriously, if that makes sense.
Oh, like, of course. And that
really
comes
chill with myself. Yeah.
And interacting with you, it comes through. You know, there's a lightness and humor that comes across.
For sure. Yeah.
But, you know, going back to the whole authenticity thing, you know, it's interesting that you studied social work as a kid, is what I would call a kid at this point.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, well before you found recovery, let alone long-term recovery.
For sure. Yeah.
Where most
of the people in our little world who work in addiction, and most of the time they never thought about doing this kind of work.
I know. Listen, Tom, I have stories. I mean, I was a tech for an all-boys court-appointed adolescent home.
Yeah.
When I was like 19. I mean, it was
boy. I
ridiculous.
Bet they loved you, didn't they?
I mean, they ran all over me. You know, yeah. I let them do whatever they wanted to. But it's just so funny. Yeah, it's just so funny. Like everything we've lived, you know. I did have a heart for it, though. You're right. I mean, yeah. I had such a heart for it even then.
Well, and you know, I had a lot of a handful of ideas about professions that I wanted to undertake when I grew up. But deep down, mm-hmm. the one thing I knew is mm-hmm. that I wanted to help people.
And I didn't, that's right.
I didn't know what that was ever going to look
exactly.
like.
Yeah.
But I knew I had a heart for helping people.
Sure. Yeah. My, you know, I had gone to a therapist. It was an LCSW when I was 16 years old. And for my own problem, you know, I had a lot of problems as a teen as well. And my mom sent me to a therapist. And that's where I got the idea of like, I want to be an LCSW. And it was based on the amount of money we paid her per hour. You know, but actually, you know, and just being, you know, my mom suffered herself with her own addictions and seeing her pain through those teenage years. I think that's probably where my mindset was at that time, Tom. Like at 18 years old, I wanted to be a social worker to figure out this addiction. And like try to stop it and try to learn about it and try to, you know, I had no clue though. I had no clue that I was in my own addiction. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I think my interest was basically like a codependent interest in trying to fix my mom, maybe, or, mm-hmm. you know, unconsciously trying to fix myself. It was, you know, but it was rooted in innocence, I think, and just trying to figure my own self out. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I mean, I knew, like you, I knew I wanted to help people. I just didn't really know what that was going to look like. But boy, what a beautiful picture it is when we can finally see that mm-hmm. picture of like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, this
well, is and, like a, you know, one of the things that I've enjoyed over the years as I've grown older is to be able to look back and
yeah.
look back at some of the really confusing times where at the time I probably thought like, why the hell am I doing this?
For sure.
And then years later, look back and see, it all makes sense. It all led
yes.
me to where I am right now.
Yes, it is. It's such a beautiful picture. You're just like, holy moly. We don't see it when we're like in the trenches of it. But man, when we look back and we're like, oh, that's why, mm-hmm. you know, and just, it's really, really a cool journey. It's hard to kind of put that into words when you're talking to someone who's new in recovery from addiction, but it's, you know, to sit here and talk to you about it, it really is a beautiful, and I know that you get it, you know, that yeah. journey and that,
well,
you know,
listen, I mean, just talking to you this much, if I never had another conversation with you, I would know that like me, you know, that some of the hardest things you've been through, even in the last few years of your life,
mm-hmm.
you're better because of them.
Because like, of it.
And, you know, some of the deepest, darkest, most painful places I've been, you know, they changed my life for the better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be who I am now without going to those dark places, which I would never choose.
Yeah.
But
I know
what strengthens us as human beings.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, you know, there is I would be lying if I said there's not a little bit of a fear of judgment on my part to be outing myself as a female sex and love addict. You know, there is that fear, and you know, I think it's a healthy fear right now. I know that my therapist is like, you know, once you really heal, like fully heal from this place, you won't even care. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true. But you know, just being able to say it and kind of outing myself, there is a fear, but also such a freedom on the other side of that too. There's such a freedom and just the knowledge of, I know if I was a person on the other end of this hearing that I went through, you know, I would feel some relief. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And feel like, okay, I think somebody else has been through this, or I think somebody else gets it.
Right.
You know, so, it's so important, and it's such a bigger picture too. It really has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with the next person and the next person, you know?
Well, it does in that walking through that fear and getting to the other side, because, you know, this podcast has been my path to authenticity in a lot of ways. But it's one thing to go to a 12-step meeting and raise your hand and say, hey, I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, I have let it all hang out for the most part. And when you record that, where, I mean, literally, I have had people all around the globe listening to this, you know, I mean, it was scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just to put my voice out there, let alone bare my soul.
Yeah.
You know, but I also knew if I'm going to do this, I need to really show up.
Oh, heck yeah.
And now here's the time. This is it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then a year later, I look back at it and it feels like it was almost like no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll experience that, where you'll look back and this will just be a blip of, oh man, there's so many bigger things than that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. I already am in some ways. It's just, you know, at the stage I'm at, me and my kids, we have, you got to think about it. Okay. Like, okay. So the most important people in my life are my kids, my parents, and my siblings. Right this second, you know, and, you know, and then it's my girlfriends and things like that. So, my kids and I have such a cool relationship, and like we have such an open communication of like, they get explained things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they know things in a way that we didn't necessarily, and it's not that my parents were trying to hurt me. They just didn't know how the hell to talk to me when I was 12. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard. It is not a fun, you know, but they've learned so much. And plus, my kids have been born in recovery, so they know me to be nothing but recovering. So, and they have been exposed to meetings and women 12-stepping people here in the house, you know, and just like nothing but recovery oriented things. So our communication is at a level that's just not the norm probably, but, you know, it's at a really cool place to where it's not necessarily the fear of their judgment, because, oh my God, I know that, you know, we speak to each other and they are just gonna, you know, understand it all. It's more, I think, my parents, and like, then I go into after my parents, even though I don't even think it's their judgment. I think it's like, you know, their friends' judgment.
All
worried about what mom and dad's friends or mom and dad's, like, my hometown are going
to
think.
We don't want to hurt the people we love.
And we don't want to hurt the people we love, you know? So it's like, getting through that piece has really been important for me, and important for my parents too. You know, there was a time when they were really embarrassed about my addiction, you know, and now they're just at such a proud point.
Yeah.
So it's a cool journey really for everybody involved in this stuff, you know?
Well, you know, and as someone who's been sober a long time and whose mom flew with him to make sure he wouldn't run away on his way to rehab.
Right.
Which, I mean, does it get much more pathetic than that?
Right.
We don't think about in those moments, we don't think about, you know, 3, 5, 10 years down the road, how your mom is bragging to her friends about you.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's because that's what I've experienced, you know,
for sure.
I mean, I have conversations with my mom and I think, man, her friends must just get sick and tired of her talk about me, you know, because based on the things she says. But my heart swells up when I, you know, it's a gift that we give to the people we love too.
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome,
and especially because everybody suffers with this. Who doesn't? Mm-hmm. Have someone they love or yes. someone in their, at least in their extended family with some sort of, bad yeah. relationship with a substance or behavior or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's important that we normalize it in such a way to reduce the shame, not right. to normalize it like, oh, everybody's addicted. No, yeah. not like it's cool or anything. It's about, you know, the shame reduction of it all. Like, let's just normalize this right here and right now, you know? Like, who hasn't dealt with being very embarrassed and very, you know, in so much pain, but not being able, not seeing a way out, right. you know? Or all of us can identify with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we can't, then we know somebody who can, or we're related to somebody who can. And, you know, and that really helps people to take that shame out of the equation so that they can be vulnerable enough to be like, yo, like, look at me. I'm suffering over here. Let me try this. Like, let me try it your way, you know? Or even, you know, parents too. I mean, I'm just watching this whole thing, especially being quarantined with their kids.
Yeah.
You know, I see on social media and stuff, parents are like, so, you know, they're tripping up over like homeschooling their kids or like being this perfect mom. And it's like, dude, it's okay. We're all in this together. And like, so what that this is a small blip on everybody's radar screen. At the end of the day, you know, at the end of our lives, we'll look at this as like, you know, we did what we had to do to get by at that time.
Right.
You know what I mean? So what that my son may be a professional Fortnite player after all right, right. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to look at the bigger picture here. I'm able to come back here and do my, you know, I'm able to come back here to my home office and do my work so that I can provide for these kids. And then, you know, at night we're going to eat dinner and watch a movie and play a board game or something like that together, which we're not doing on school nights because we're too busy in the hustle and bustle of things, right. you know? So these kids will not get homeschooled like they're supposed to, nor am I going to beat myself up to make myself think that I could possibly be a teacher when actually I'm a therapist, you know? And that's what I am. I can be a mom, you know, and I can set them at the computer and help them to get organized to learn. But as far as like being some kind of like awesome teacher while, you know, making sure that they eat and the bills get paid and that, you know, we can't expect ourselves to be everything and just kind of giving ourselves that grace of like, you know, and we're all in this together. We really are. And I don't know. It was kind of cool. Last night we made we made cupcakes, you know, my daughter and I, and it was like we didn't have eggs because the store is out of freaking eggs, you know?
Yeah.
And we didn't have regular icing. I bought the only icing they had left was vegan, gluten-free icing. Oh, yeah. And so we had really crumbly cupcakes. You know, they were quarantine cupcakes. They, you know, but it's like something that would only happen during a global pandemic when right. the grocery stores are empty. You know what I mean? So it was kind of like a comical thing that we just give ourselves grace. The cupcakes came out terribly, but we all ended up eating a cupcake, you know, and right. it was like a funny thing. So I don't know, just, yeah, bringing in the humanness of all of this is that authenticity, you know, and just being like, hey, I am me and I can't expect to be anything but me, right now. So, but I'll be the best me that yeah. I can be, you
well,
know,
and, you I, know, I mean, you're touching on, you know, one of the hard lessons I've had to learn over the years is like, dude, give yourself a break.
Yeah.
Like we're so hard on ourselves and
yeah,
we train ourselves to see what's missing.
Yeah.
You know, we don't look at all the stuff we're doing right. And from where mm-hmm. we're standing, it's almost impossible to see the big picture.
Yeah.
Remind ourselves to, you know, yeah. we have to try and
yes.
And you know, I don't know about you, but this pandemic thing, I mean, this is hard shit.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. You know, I was talking in this group with young guys today, sharing some of my, like, I've had a hard time with this. Like, I've had friends get on my ass because I'm not being communicative. Because I want to, you know, roll up into a ball.
Yeah.
Because if I allow myself to think about this in enough detail, it's like really depressing, you know?
Yes.
It's really, really depressing. And, you know, because, and aside from the illness aspect or what could happen to the economy and all that, I mean, just being shut in.
Yes.
And for me, especially at a place in my life where, you know, I got a couple challenging things going on, but they'll yes. pass. But for the most part, I'm pretty happy. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm pretty happy with my social life and my romantic life. And now all of a sudden, like, we're not supposed to see anybody face, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It put everything came to a screeching halt. So there's been a little bit of Tom sitting on the pity pot because he can't do, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's sure. been going on, you know?
Yep. And that's the human in all of us, you know, that yeah. is just you being a human being. And we're going to go through all of those emotions. And each and every one of us, you know, just because I'm a therapist doesn't make me immune from feeling life's part problems, you know? Mm. So, and it's just how we go about it and how we handle it.
Yeah. It's and you so know, that emotions are, you know, so important in the healing process too. Our relationships with our emotions. I mean, mm-hmm. usually I think about that as like all of it, like the
yeah
but you know, someone who we both respect said to me in a therapy session a year or so ago, you know, I was talking to her about, man, you know, this pain, it's like so exhausting.
Yeah.
And she said, your resistance to the pain is what's exhausting.
Is what's exhausting.
It's like that, and it like a light went off in my head. She's absolutely yeah. right. It's not that I hurt, because we all hurt. It's that I'm trying not to hurt.
Tom, I know. I remember, you know, for me, it was crying. Like the emotion of sadness has always been the hardest for me to express, right? I could be angry. I could definitely be funny. God knows that, you know, that's my way, my defenses, you know, is to like try to crack some jokes or bring up some humor. But, you know, sadness or loneliness was definitely something that I avoided at all costs. Mm-hmm. And the resistance to that feeling, the resistance to just freaking feeling that emotion was so much harder and painful than just actually allowing myself to cry. I actually, cause this is something that I've worked on myself in therapy, you know, is when I allow myself just to have a good cry. Oh my God. Like it takes like 15 minutes and then I'm done and I can move on about my day. It doesn't completely encompass every bit of my being like it does when I try to resist it. Mm-hmm. And then it ruins my day. And then it ruins my
everyone work around you.
It ruins everyone around me. It ruins what I wanted to do today for work. It ruins, like, it is so powerful when we try. And I guess that's where all of our sick addictive patterns came from, right? Was from trying to resist just feeling that one emotion. And I could track back, really, in therapy, I was able to track back to some really early memories of wanting to cry and feeling those tears come up in my eyes and like quickly shoving it down, you know, and shoving it back down and let me, you know, get angry and fight my brother or let me get, you know, let me shut down and go in my room and completely isolate. You know, those were the things that I would do to shut down that just feeling a simple cry, just a simple, like, let me be sad for a minute. I deserve to just be sad for a minute, you know, and like, wow, what an epiphany that's been, you know, is to like realize that, you know, just accepting our emotions, like what's coming up for me right now. I'm sad. I want to be sad. I want to cry. You know, that's what's coming up for me. Or, you know, oh, the fear of not being perfect during this quarantine. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what's coming up for me. And, you know, and my another defense of mine is when I fear not being perfect, then I go into rebellion. And that's been probably my newest thing that I've been working on with my own self-development is like that, you know, learning the middle of not needing to be perfect and obedient, but not needing to be rebellious and out of control either, you know, and like realizing that that is self-love to like not be rebellious either, you know?
Yeah.
So it's different for all of us and we all go through so many cool twists and turns and hills and mountains. And
layers of it. Layers.
Oh my God, the layers.
Because, you know, I've known for a long time that it was okay to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically.
Sure.
But what I didn't know, and I would allow myself to be sad sometimes, but what I didn't realize is how I was really how frozen I was with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, sadness has been a big thing for me too, especially in the last couple of years, because I mean, for the longest time, and I just, so much of what you just said, I relate to, I mean, allowing myself to cry and how much better you feel. But for the longest time, I could look back on my life and the things that hurt. And I was cool with like talking about these events. You know, it's not like I was pretending they didn't happen.
They didn't happen. Like, absolutely.
I was talking about them to people who were safe and all that stuff. But what I had never, and for years I thought, you know, I can't figure out what my core issue, you know, what the, you know, I'm just like was dying to get to the unravel this knot. And I finally realized, you know, it's not about any one of these events or anything. And it's not about that I'm avoiding any of it. It's that I never allowed myself to stand back and look at the big picture and see all of those things from a bird's eye view and acknowledge how sad it was. And there were reasons for that. Like, you know, because it was pretty clear to me as a little kid, like, you don't want to show sadness. Like, you will be destroyed. Like that's not okay to do. So I trained myself not to do it. And, you know, in hindsight, I look back and I always thought of myself as this sentimental person because I'd listen to these sad songs and I'd start crying. And the first vivid memory I have of it was Don McLean, American Pie. The first time I heard that, you know, it's about Buddy Holly dying in a plane crash. And I'm crying to this as a, I don't know, 12-year-old. Well, hell, Buddy Holly was dead for 30 years already at this point. Like, I'd never even heard his music or anything. And I'm crying to this sad song. And I realized a couple years ago, you know, that's not because I'm a sentimental guy. That's not the reason why is because it was safe to cry at a movie or a sad song or, you know, just, and I had tears that needed to come out. But, you know, dealing with real life stuff, like, you know, the sadness that came with the things that happened in my world. I mean, those things weren't okay to acknowledge and shed tears about, but, you know, Buddy Holly dying, that's totally cool. You know, so it's really interesting how we adapt to survive, you know, invalidation.
For sure.
Yeah. But, you know, this is like, I've talked about this and I'm sure you feel the same way is that I feel really fortunate that this stuff fascinates me because I know a lot of guys who just like they may be willing to get sober and work the steps and okay, but like I'm not going to that ACA meeting. Like you know, like a lot of people don't want to look deeper, but because it's painful or just because they're not intellectually stimulated by it or whatever. But I want to know what makes me tick. Yeah, but I feel like that has been an advantage to me because I've embraced the deeper levels of healing because of it. Because I was intrigued and I was fascinated.
So yes. Yeah, exactly. It is a gift. It is a true gift. You're right.
So what's next for you, Kim? Do you have more training that you're doing or?
No, now I'm like, I guess my latest, I'm working on my book. I know 2 years ago, you and I talked about
that's
my book
right.
That I never really did, but now I'm serious about it and actually writing it and actually have, you know, the writing coach and have a deadline and, you know, I hope to be a published author this time next year. So that's cool. But what I'm really working on right now is I've been asked by a treatment center. It's so funny, like how stuff, like I may not have thought of this unless somebody had asked me to do this, right? And and it's like the opportunity came up and I was like, oh my God, I'll bet people need this. And so a treatment center reached out to me. It was a treatment center for females. And she was like, will you please train my staff on female sex and love addiction? And she was so cute. She was like, you know, our website says we treat female sex and love addiction. She said, but we don't. Or, you know, that they not treat it, but you know, that they help people with it or whatever. Right. And, I was like, I would love that. So I have put together, or I'm putting together trainings, and I've done one with her staff, and they loved it so much. Now it's going to be a recurring month thing that I do, a training for her staff once a month on female sex and love addiction, which looks like, and I put together a bit of a curriculum. And that's cool. And it's really just for all treatment centers, and for sex addiction, period, to go in and train people, other therapists, how to actually, how to do this, because, the regular, the regular man ban, and if you're not in the treatment industry, you won't understand this term, but having the girl sign a contract that she won't date or have sex with any men, that doesn't necessarily, may not work for a female sex and love addict, it may shame them more, Right. And it's not to not and say that's not a good way, but, let's look at it some other ways. That may shame the female sex and love addict. Let's look at it another way, And so to just kind of educate them on more therapeutic and more alternatives that we can use to kind of treat this, as well as what to look for, because, a lot of us are like, really? Is that even a real thing? Is sex addiction a real thing? Yes, it is. And there's actual criteria for it. You know what I mean? And so to just educate on that simplistic, yet let's look at the criteria here. And this really is a thing. And so that kind of, is one of the trainings. We also do case consults, and things like that. So it's a really cool opportunity for treatment centers who want to be, better, who want right. to, like any treatment center who offers a lot of trainings to their staff, that those tend to be the better treatment centers because they're open to, more trainings and more opportunities to grow their staff. Mm-hmm. Those are the more successful ones and the more quality.
Yeah. Well, and it's really important, and I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast and just in my work, because one of the things that drives me crazy, well, first of all, I caught on pretty early on in my career, the people who I really, really respected were people who, kind of kept the awareness that these are yes. human beings that we're dealing with families yes. and lives, and all of this is disrupting it. And, these are people here.
Mm-hmm.
And, it happens. These things become labels. Codependent, sex mm-hmm. addict, love mm-hmm. addict. And there are an awful lot of people in our industry who use those labels
mm-hmm.
to describe clients. And even mm-hmm. with them, you mm-hmm. are a sex addict or you are codependent, and they don't even know what the hell it is.
Dude, let's go a step more tragic.
Or they suffer from it themselves.
Yes, for sure. And even more tragic, they will label them borderline or narcissistic.
Yeah.
And which, a man who's kind of tough to handle in treatment, he's all of a sudden the narcissist, and a woman who's kind of tough in treatment all of a sudden becomes a borderline. And it's like, do you even know what that is? You know what I mean? And when you do know, we as therapists kind of joke around about stuff like that, but it's not okay to like label a patient, as that, unless we know for sure, and it's a very small percentage of the population. So,
yeah,
especially
with, support staff who don't have a lot of training, and
right.
the next thing you know, they see therapists running around describing someone as a borderline, and, And yeah. they're and using they that term all the time.
Yes. Yes. And yes. And nobody really is. Yeah. Nobody really knows either. And yet the patient certainly will wear it around like a badge, you know, yeah. And that's just another, you know, label or shame stigma that they put on themselves. It could. That's a potential danger. So, yeah. That's funny.
Well, and with younger clients, it's that oppositional defiance that they get. Yeah.
ODD.
Labeled with that. And,
yes.
And then, you know, I've, you know, when you said wear it around like a badge, I mean, that's a specific face came to mind of a client. Is wearing yes. that, you know?
Yes, yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's
and it's like almost they're like, okay, so this is my identity now. So then they start being that.
Yeah, well, and it reminds me of when I first got sober, there's a term that I used to hear, junkie pride. And it was before the opioid epidemic.
Uh-huh. Where,
you know, heroin addicts had this attitude where, you know, they're just so much cooler than someone who drinks or smokes pot or does coke yeah. or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a thing. It really was a thing. You know, it was back then it did take a certain personality of person to become an opiate addict
mm-hmm.
or to become a cocaine addict. And that's one of the things that's really changed. I remember being taught, you know, and becoming trained as a counselor that typically people who use drugs that were more kind of on the fringe, like heroin or cocaine, they tended to have a higher frequency of acute mental health issues. And now it's just like everyone's an opiate addict. I mean, it's so prevalent now that it's just everywhere. And part of me, I just thank God that like when I got sober and I was doing my thing, it wasn't cool to take pills. Like people didn't do that really where I grew up. I mean, some, but man, if you did, that was... I mean, I remember guys saying to me, like older friends I had who I partied with, who would say, man, pills are gross. Like, who takes pills? And now it's like, who doesn't take pills? Like everybody showing up in treatment has been taking pills practically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is in this quite a ride to be on, to be living in this world. And
it's such
to go
a ride.
Through all this stuff. It really is.
Totally.
But, you know, I mean, I really wouldn't have it any other way, and I'm sure you wouldn't either. I mean, I like who I am now.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so happy that this is the girl who is quarantined.
Yeah.
And not me a few years ago. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're at a much more peaceful space. I do find it, you know, just me being authentic here and me being 1000% real. I find it a little bit harder when the kids aren't here with me just because it's more of like, I have to sit with self,
yeah.
you know, you know, when I lean into it for exactly what it is and exactly for what my higher power has put me in this position for, you know what I mean? Then it kind of can, it's like a little bit of a better, outlook instead of like that, like you were talking earlier, that victim-y mode, like why me and why do I have to sit here, you know? So
well, I've gotten over the hump with it to where I'm okay, so how can I be productive here? What good can I
exactly what,
and here's an idea that I'll throw out there while I have you, and maybe you'll want to do this, I'll invite you, but you know, working in the addiction treatment industry, and consulting with clients who are in treatment and families of clients who are in treatment, like in that world, everything's quickly changed. Like you can't really go to a 12-step meeting right now.
Exactly.
You know, group therapy is virtual.
Like yes,
most
exactly.
of the time. And people who are in addiction treatment facilities or supportive living, they're kind of stuck.
They're stuck, yeah.
And if the places are doing a good job and doing a good job, they're not letting them leave and come and go.
Right.
You know, so, and it just, it got me thinking about, you know, there's an absence, or it's showing up and it's becoming more refined. I think ultimately this is going to improve our industry going through this, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. like, you know, there are all these Zoom meetings taking place and stuff.
And no, it's awesome.
But one of the things, you know, I never really wanted to have a recovery podcast. I wanted this to be bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, the authenticity thing, it applies, but it also, it's, you know, anyone can benefit from listening to a conversation like this, I think, whether or not you have an addiction issue or you love someone mm-hmm. who does. But having started a podcast, like, the hard part's over. Like, to start another
yes.
one, it's not that big a deal. And I am going to start another podcast mm-hmm. that's not really about me or anything, but... You know, I'm going to call it How It Happened, and I want them to be approximately 30-minute episodes where a person comes on and tells their story like they would if they were going into a treatment facility as an alumni speaker and talking oh, for cool. half an hour, and have it be, you know, not Kim Litton, Kim right. L., you know,
yeah.
to honor the traditions and all that. But it, you know, it would be relatively easy for me to do that. And a lot of people would be willing to contribute to that, probably more than who would want to be interviewed on something like this. And I think it could be, it's something that could be useful to a lot of people right now to just hear someone tell their story. Someone mm-hmm. who's been through it. And because, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sitting a Zoom meeting for me before any of this happened was kind of tough. Just a regular meeting, like a business meeting. But to try to think of that and doing a 12-step meeting that way, I mean, it's not like sitting in a room full of people. It's just not. It's a little different.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm inviting you formally to do that.
Well, thank you. I would love that.
Okay. So I'll keep yes. you posted with that. And, but, you know, this has been great, but just, I guess, to wrap things up, like,
yeah.
you've been through a lot, like I have. If there was something you could go back to tell that younger self, when did she need to hear it and what was it she needed to hear?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about this question. Okay. So, and I'm really, you know, kind of experiencing this right now because my daughter, who is just like, I feel like I'm raising myself, as I'm raising her, it's really cool experience. So that girl, if I'm my smaller self that I needed guidance, I really needed guidance when I was 12, 13, and 14 years old. And what would I tell her? I would tell her, you know, that you are really perfect the way you are, and you really don't need to, try to be like someone else. And, you know, I would go into more detail, obviously, because that's what I was experiencing at that time. But, you know, I went from being a really quiet girl who had a quiet confidence. I see this in my daughter. It's a really quiet confidence about her. And I feel like I had that at some point and I lost it because I started going to, you know, maybe what's going to make me popular or what is going to make people see me more, what's going to get me more attention. Instead of just being perfectly perfect with myself, perfectly imperfect with myself, kind of, you know, like, so I'm kind of fostering that with, my daughter because I see that in her. Like, she's not the quote popular girl. You know, she's not the quote, like, girl that all the boys like or whatever, you know, whatever it, this may be. But that, like, she is 1000% okay with that. No, and, like, not only is she okay with it, she, it doesn't even register in her mindset as, like, a thing, you know?
Right.
And I would be that person for myself if I could go back. And I really think that would have molded a different me, you know, which, of course, you know, I'm glad I have me because this is, you know, my path has gotten me here, as we've talked about. But that's exactly where I would go. And that's what I would tell her.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Kim. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Well, I really appreciate you. Yeah. Thank you for asking me. I'm very honored to be a part of this, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'll talk to you soon. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit Equivox.com.